It gives me great pleasure to have the opportunity to spend this morning with you and talk about some of the work that I've been involved in over the last few years. It's a real pleasure to be here, and even more so, to particularly to have your attention. And I look forward to lots of stimulating conversations and back and forth, both this morning and then over the rest of the program. I picked a very broad title, for those who don't know me, I'm in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at Brown University. I've been there for 4 years. And those of you that know my work know that one of the things I'm particularly interested in are evolutionary trajectories, and I think it helps maybe to motivate the first part of this talk if we review my developmental trajectory. So I hope this isn't too self-indulgent, but I began years ago with a degree in computer science and ended up as an assistant professor in biology. And yes, Jeff, I do consider myself a biologist now. And I wanted to sort of walk through some of the key events, key ideas, that and how they kind of came together to motivate then the body of the talk. So I began years ago as an undergraduate, stumbled into this guy's upper level course on genetic algorithms. John Holland is one of the original premier thinkers in the field of evolutionary computation. Those of you that don't know, there's a strongly parallel community of interest in the dynamics and other questions associated with the Darwinian paradigm in the world of computers, and that's probably familiar to all of you in the context of Aveda, but which has now been brought into biology. But there's a broader sort of engineering application that John made important contributions to, and it really blew my mind when I took his class. So in order to build a genetic algorithm, you require some kind of bit string representation of all conceivable solutions. So this is I have a problem in mind. If I want the next digit of pi, I can write a program that will compute the next digit of pi, but there are lots and lots of problems that we don't understand that well. So the notion here is, let's do what natural selection has done in nature, this is what natural selection has done, and see if we can't evolve computer programs that perform some required task. So we imagine that we require a bit string representation of all conceivable such programs. Well, that's easy to do, just strings of zeros and ones in the computer's memory, and some way of evaluating each possible solution with respect to the problem that we're trying to solve. And if you've got those two pieces, then this is what you do. You initialize a population of typically random solutions, typically order of 1,000 of them, and then you iterate, just as Darwin said, a succession of selection, where you evaluate every solution and keep the ones that seem to be doing better, and produce new ones with some error via either genetic crossover, something like genetic crossover, and or mutation. Selection can be deterministic or stochastic, include some of the things we know, like fitness proportional, and some of the ones that we would really scratch our heads over, like tournament selection.
The bit string would represent an approximation to the digits of pi, or a program.
Thank you, David. The bit string represents, the bit strings represent alternative programs, and we're trying to find a program that does some task for which we can't write an algorithm a priori.
And they would have a grammar that about, you know, do loops and start and stop.
Yes, and with everything that's interesting, the devil's in the details, and so these things work better if you stumble on. The success that you have is in part profoundly dependent on the particular representation that you employ. That's the way the engineer would say it. Anyways, after some number of generations, or reaching some level of fitness that you decide in advance, this all stops, and you open up the box, and you look inside, and you see whether you got any programs that actually did what you wanted, and maybe you keep them. And, so I want to emphasize this notion, which runs right through everything I'm going to say today. This is the way I think about fitness functions. It's a lookup table, and on the left, you have all the possible bit strings that you can imagine. So there are, in this, there are maybe we're working in a world of L strings of length L, and I just enumerate them in the canonical order that a computer scientist would. Those are the binary digits from the binary. Those are the numbers from 0 to 2 to the L represented, 2 to the L minus 1 represented in binary code. And on the right side is some measure of fitness, just a lookup table. And all you need to make a go at it with a genetic algorithm is some way of evaluating the fitness of each of these strings in your population. This, of course, immediately brought to mind already then, for me, I didn't know as Wright's fitness landscape. I thought a lot about fitness landscapes. I mean, this is essential to understanding whether genetic algorithms are going to work or not, is that some sense of the ruggedness of the fitness landscape that you've set for yourself. And again, the shape of the topology of the fitness, the topography of the fitness landscape is profoundly dependent on how you represent your problem in the bitstream. So here what we've done is to project over the L-dimensional hypercube, and for those of you here last week, there was a lot of talk about the L-dimensional hypercube in Chris's talk, Chris Marx's talk. In fact, Paul Dane in 1932 talked about exactly this object, L-dimensional hypercube, and I would just want to make note now that that construct readily generalizes to more than two alleles at each locus. It's not terribly surprising that if the genetic code is built out of an alphabet of four instead of two, things won't change materially. They don't, and that may turn up again later in the talk as well. Now, I was, as an undergraduate, really impressed and fascinated, because genetic algorithms are an unsupervised search heuristic with some tremendous successes in computational biology.
Really? Of course, what are the tremendous successes?
Well,
tremendous, are they?
Yeah, I don't want to. I'm not in this field. I don't want to defend it. But as
you just have to defend one word.
Checkers. Yeah. So there was a successful checkers game that was produced by this approach. We'll talk about it afterwards. Yeah. Not the hardest problem in the world, but.
But not solved checkers.
Certainly not chess.
Checkers was already solved completely.
By this time.
Hmm.
By
long time ago. I mean,
possible moves. Checkers was only solved a couple of years ago.
No, not if you're allowed to do any opening move. Then it's quite a long time ago.
I confess. I'll acknowledge ignorance here. At the time, it seemed to me quite impressive, and there were some examples, and I believe checkers was one of them. But it's possible that's not correct. Anyways, obviously, this is not the application that any of us are particularly interested in. At least I'm not interested in today. The thing that was exciting for me is that it opened a window into the world of biology that I felt my mind could access. We regard Darwin's model as an algorithm. In some sense, when I'm feeling philosophical, it occurs to me to suggest that this point motivates a variant of anthropic principle, namely the solutions that we see in biology are exactly solutions to the problems that are amenable to this heuristic. This kind of comes to the connection between what we can motivate, how we motivate our interests intellectually, and this is not the kind of biology that I do, but this is somehow on an intuitive level tremendously appealing, the diversity of shapes and sizes and colors and forms and interactions and all of that, and so I just sort of filed that away. But when I finished my degree in computer science, I was at a fork in the road. Do I want to go to graduate school or do I want to make money? And I didn't really understand. I wasn't really ready to go to graduate school. It wasn't clear to me that computer science was the way to go. And being an undergraduate, I was poor, so I went the other route. And lots of nice things followed. I spent about 10 years in industry and grew up in a lot of other dimensions. But after a while, 5 or 6 years of this, realizing I wasn't going to be as rich as Midas or even Steve Jobs, I started to kind of think again about what it was that made me happy. And for me, at least, the engineering that I was doing was a lot like working on crossword puzzles. I mean, it was easy work in a lot of respects, but it wasn't that rewarding. So I came back to this kind of thinking and asked myself, began to wonder whether computationally minded framework could get intellectual traction in evolutionary genetics. So one more detour before we get to the talk. I enrolled in a program at this school in Cambridge with this guy, Dick Lewontin. That's some years ago. This is the Dick Lewontin that I worked with. And joined what he even called the Find 'em and Grind 'em School of Population Genetics, which took as its program to go in nature and survey levels of genetic variation and some interest in divergence between populations and species and make statistical inferences from what Dick calls the static data, standing variation, back into the process axis of evolution. So this was a tremendously important paper that still cast a long shadow. This was published in 83, Marty Kreitman's thesis, the first paper to go and look at compare levels of polymorphism at synonymous and replacement sites. That, of course, stands on the shoulders of this paper, Dick's, one of Dick's breakthroughs, in which he showed a great deal of high, tremendously high levels of molecular variation at lots and lots of proteins in this fruit fly. This is the kind of apparatus that we used, making estimates of these basic population genetic parameters from observations in nature. But again, but for me, it was a little bit empty because I was interested, as a computer scientist, thinking about dynamics of evolution over fitness functions. And this is what passed for dynamics in that that framework. And you know, it was clear already that what was interesting was when effects of mutations were conditioned on genetic background.
Just a historical question. Where did Kimura fit in to Lewontin at all? Did he guide them? Were they opposed to him? What happened historically?
I'm a little bit close to the story to tell you the definitive. This paper says there are several ways we can explain this level of polymorphism, and neutrality is one of them. That's a fact. It's my sense, though, that Kimura thought that the other explanations that were motivated in that paper, which were selective, relegated this group to the pan-selectionist community. But Dick certainly was aware of the tension.
Thank you.
Everyone was. So I then became, well, actually in graduate school, I became interested in experiment, became impressed by what you can do with microbes, didn't have a clue how to get into it, and I don't need to review this to this group, but just to be quick about it. In microbes, we can regulate and manipulate population size, population density, mutation rate, recombination rate, the environment. We can regulate and manipulate the genomes. We can practically grow these populations for tens of thousands of generations, preserve them all in the freezer for later analysis, including fitness assays and whole genome sequencing. It really is, I don't have to preach in the choir, it's a superb toolkit for getting at the things that I was interested in. And in this regard, I was influenced first by this man, Bruce Levin, who came to Harvard a couple times and gave talks that really excited me, but I didn't really understand how that connected with the work that I was doing. It's hard to find your way out of a thesis or out of graduate school. Bruce is a tremendously colorful character. If you've not had the opportunity to meet him, either hear him speak or to meet him over a drink, I encourage you to do that. Here are a couple of quotes that I pulled off his website that are particularly germane for us today. Doing research in population biology without mathematical and or computer simulations is like playing tennis without a net or boundary lines. I don't think anyone here would disagree. And this one I like even better. For us, natural and not so natural selection is about BNDT, not BNDS. So Bruce was the first person that turned me on to the power of these systems. I then met this man, Lin Chao, more or less my last day of graduate school. He came to Harvard to give a talk. He was presenting work of Christina's, the first chapter of her thesis. He gave a talk entitled Fisher and Wright and Fisher, Evolution by Small Jerks. I was an early bird. My kids were young in those days, and I used to get to the lab about 8, and Lynn came at about 8:30, and we ended up having the whole morning together before anyone else rolled in. And a tremendously influential person for me, ended up doing an important postdoc with him. So that's the introduction. That's a brief and I hope not too self-indulgent autobiographical sketch. I now want to get to the body of the talk. This is a slide. This is the slide that Sergey showed us the other day. I think it's spot on in the way it partitions the problems that we have before us, the conceptual levels at which we can work. And I've made some efforts in each of these areas, and I'm just going to follow this structure. So let's get started. I suppose we can quibble with the organization, and it hardly matters. I might move, the way I'm going to talk about it, I'm going to move mutation rate and recombination rates into the population dynamics piece of it. I sort of regard it, you can see, I mean, I came to all of this thinking about fitness functions or fitness landscapes. And so this is really the skeleton, and these other things are appendices I don't mean to in any way minimize their importance or their complexity, but just the fulcrum for me is about topologies of topographies of fitness landscapes. And we'll do it a little bit out of order. We'll begin with fitness landscapes, and then I'll talk a little about work we've done at the lower level, and time permitting, talk about work at the top. Okay? So part one, fitness landscapes. And I'm going to make a few points here. How can we use them? That is to say, what do they tell us? What are they actually like? So we and several other people have made characterizations of very small regions of these things. And when do they fail us, most importantly? And I want to emphasize what's obvious. We don't all know each other that well. Our fields don't all know each other's fields that well. What's really of equal value to talking about successes is talk about weaknesses and areas of growth and limitations. So I want to be real upfront and not gloss over anything. So when we get to some of this, I'm going to stop and ask people to call out some other limitations that I might have overlooked, because I think that's good for all of us. So this is where I usually start my stump speech, and I apologize for those of you that have seen this sequence before. This is from The New Yorker, and it illustrates the evolution of a businessman from the ancestral necktie. And to motivate that, we can use that to motivate quite a bit of what we're going to see. Evolution, this is evolution and not development, because if it were development, then the cartoonist would have shown an egg cracking open here instead of the primordial ooze. So evolution changes phenotype in a heritable way. First here, the acquisition of the head, and then the limbs, and then the torso. To be heritable, we need some genetics, and so this is the simplest three locus two allele system I can think of. Lowercase h becomes capital H, and we get a head. Lowercase l becomes capital L, we get limbs, and lowercase h becomes lowercase t becomes capital T, we get a torso. And the reason I do this is to bring us now to the hypercube that I've already alluded to. Nucleotide sequence space defines many mutationally equivalent trajectories. And here I want to acknowledge, because this is in the interest of full disclosure, I want to acknowledge that I'm assuming strong selection, weak mutation. In other words, I'm assuming that populations are only very transiently polymorphic. Mutations happen, and then they're either, on the time scale of mutations appearing, they're either lost or fixed instantly. So this idea was made explicit by Maynard Smith, but really it's there in full form, nearly in full form, in Wright's influential paper from 1932 that we already saw a picture from earlier this week. Many mutational trajectories, and one question one might ask, the question I became interested in, is whether natural selection is empirically constrained to follow a subset of these trajectories, or are they all interchangeable with respect to evolution, with respect to natural selection? And now we come back to the fitness landscape, and I want to say something that I meant to say before, the first time we saw this figure. There is a community of workers, particularly some philosophers, who seem to have some trouble with the notion of the fitness landscape as being a well-defined entity, as anything more than a metaphor which brings with it a lot of unacknowledged conceptual pitfalls. And I don't share that view. I think if you think about the fitness landscape as a mapping from a discrete space of sequences to fitness, you can make a lot of progress. Now, there are limitations. For example, that framework doesn't readily admit changing environment or even frequency dependence. It's not trivially obvious how to build diploid into it, although we've played around with that. But subject to those limitations, I think we can speak fairly. I think we can speak fairly rigorously about.
But strictly speaking, this space is extremely multidimensional because sequences are very long.
Yes.
So in as you define it, it's absolutely accurate definition, but it's useless because you cannot think in such a hugely dimensional space. So basically, what you assume, an extra assumption, is that you can reduce this space to some, again, something like your hypercube or whatever, that a very small part of this sequence space actually matters. Then it will become a meaningful concept, because in full sequence space you can't think about it.
There are two issues that are on your mind, or at least it suggests two issues to me. One is, as a practical matter, it's not realistic to synthesize and characterize any more than, you know, 100 or 1,000 entries in that table. And so I certainly agree that that's tremendously limiting. So you'll see at the end of this piece of the talk, I wrote a paper a few years ago in which we computed different evolution, the probability of different evolutionary trajectories to antibiotic resistance, and all of that presumes that the only mutations that matter are the small number of mutations we studied. That's wrong. So that's point one, and I grant you that. Point two, the question of can we think about it? Without being flip, I might say, speak for yourself. I mean, you can't draw.
I speak for myself. I cannot think as more in more than say five-dimensional space, and I think it's a lot already.
Yeah. So. But let's think about what it is we want to do with this. Yes, you can't draw a picture like this. But I'm not. I'm open to being convinced, and maybe I've been sloppy and lazy, but to my mind, questions like how many maxima are there are easy to answer. Not easy computationally, but conceptually, that question exists in arbitrary dimensions, including 3 × 10⁻⁹ bits of, or 4 × 10⁻⁹ bits.
But there's no experimental evidence that there are any maxima which are accessible.
Yeah.
If you try to select on one thing, that you ever get to a maximum and you list it.
Okay.
Why do the maxima matter?
Okay, I didn't say they matter. I just said that's a question you can ask.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So let's say that all I'm willing to stipulate that all populations are genetically miles and miles away from any optimum, but there's some gradients that they're following,
yeah.
Or some vector fields that are driving them. Now. You might say it doesn't help me. You might say it doesn't help me. Daniel Fisher might say it doesn't help me to think about this construct. I'm fine without it, and that's fine too. I'm not suggesting anybody should use it. I'm just not. It's not clear to me that there's anything wrong with using it, and I find it to be.
Well, okay. I guess. Yeah. Depends. Well, presumably you're going to say how you're going to use it.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I want to do is anticipate the possibility that somebody's going to turn off their mind or because they don't. In air quotes, believe in fitness landscapes. And I want to press that point. I don't think that it's a question like, God, do you believe in them or not, but do you believe they're useful or not? At least I tell you, when I sit in the audience and somebody gets out some apparatus that I don't believe in, that I don't find to be particularly helpful, or in fact, that I find misleading, I tend to turn off my mind.
There's one other aspect that you mentioned already briefly, especially if one is interested in long trajectories, and as you are and I am, then it's sort of unavoidable that the fitness landscape itself changes.
Will change.
Or at least potentially changes on those timescales.
That's right.
And then it's like a question like, what remain useful things about it?
That's right.
Maybe. Going to talk about.
How he defines it, it doesn't change. If he defines it in the space of all sequences, it does not change. What you implicitly assume that you are thinking about fitness landscape as a projection onto some axis, and then it will change as trajectory evolves.
But I think Michael is saying can we say arrange to meet this afternoon, say after in the porthole room and discuss about fitness landscape.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm actually going to say something that I hope Michael will help you feel a little better, but just to kind of anticipate the end, the punchline, I don't claim that this is the solution to all problems. I only claim this is the framework that I come to the field with, and if you're holding a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And maybe it doesn't work that well on a screw, and mea culpa, we have to talk about how to go further.
We call it a seascape. That's right.
I'll have something to say about that, time permitting. Okay, so one question that many of you have heard me talk about before, so I'm going to go rather quickly, and moreover, those of you that haven't heard it will say may be inclined to ask whether it's actually even that important or novel, has to do with the way that epistasis influences the folds on the fitness landscape. And so some years ago, before I actually got in the laboratory, but thinking now carefully about fitness landscapes and problems that they pose for evolving populations, understanding strong selection and weak mutation assumptions, I came to realize that what matters more than anything else, I suggested that what matters more than anything else is what we call sign epistasis. So, as you all, I'm sure, appreciate, in this cube, every dimension corresponds to a different locus. So I've highlighted the T locus here, the four edges along which the T mutation can occur, reflecting the four different genetic backgrounds on which it can appear. And here I've drawn a toy suggestion for fitness values, and the orange lines are the same as on the right. And by taking the log fitness here, the slope is the selection coefficient. And so there's lots and lots of epistasis. The mutation does something different than every genetic background. But importantly, it's beneficial. It's beneficial only on two backgrounds. And so I got interested in situations where the sign of the fitness effect varies epistatically and gave it the shorthand name sign epistasis. Not perfect, because people have for many years been interested in the sign of epistasis. Is it positive or negative? With respect to deleterious mutations, this is strongly positive epistasis, but it's a subset of positive epistasis. And anyways, the part that everyone will have appreciated minutes, if not years ago, is that if we bring these check marks and X's back to the hypercube, several of the trajectories then are disallowed. And so I became interested in asking in the incidence of this sign epistasis. And this is work that we published some years ago, so I'll go quickly. It's the story of antibiotic resistance. This against the class of antibiotic called beta-lactams that Jeff introduced on Monday. But indeed, this thing here is called the beta-lactam. And different beta-lactams differ in the elaborations on that ring. And naturally, a resistance in nature occurs fairly quickly after introduction of every one of these drugs, and so the pharmaceuticals will build on more decorations to try to stymie the resistance, which is often conferred by an enzyme called beta-lactamase. It's worth noting, just as a point of trivia, that methicillin is also a beta-lactam, and MRSA, methicillin resistant Staph aureus, is resistant to methicillin by a different mechanism. It's not that it hydrolyzes the drug, it's that the drug's binding target is slippery with respect to the drug. So the way the drug works is it binds to a key enzyme irreversibly, and in that Staph aureus strain, that enzyme's evolved specificity so that it's inert to the drug. 10 beta lactamases are a clinically distributed, clinically important class of beta lactamase alleles. And it was known from literature that 5-point mutations in an allele that I'll call TEMWT jointly increase resistance 100,000 fold and yield an allele that I call TEM star. It's also worth acknowledging that. The allele I call TEMWT and many of the other alleles we'll talk about have been seen clinically, but TEM star has never been seen clinically, probably because the resistance that it confers is one or two orders of magnitude higher than the concentration of the drug that you can put into a human being. It was instead described by mutagenic PCR protocol. So the question for me is, what's the topography of the, say, resistance function, fitness function line between these two alleles? And here I say, but you'll now appreciate, I did what any good computer scientist would have done. I used reverse genetics to construct each of the 32 alleles defined by all combinations of these mutations, measure the resistance of each. And on the premise that natural selection is only trying to increase drug resistance, we then have a sense of the contours of the function of the fitness landscape. Now, Jeff and I were having an interesting conversation yesterday, and it will be apparent to lots of you that how resistance maps to fitness is a subtle, complex, maybe unanswerable question. But if we at least assume that the rank orderings between resistance and fitness, that the rank orderings of fitness are the same as the rank orderings of resistance, we can make some progress. And so that's what I did. So here are the data. This is a table just like the one you already saw. In fact, I took this and gutted out the names and replaced it just with zeros and ones. As a nod to geneticists, I put pluses and minuses instead of zeros and ones. But again, there's one entry for every allele that I built. I don't show you all 32 entries. Each line is an entry. Its identity is signaled by a string of pluses and minuses. And on the right are our data. Drug resistance, this is the MIC assay. This is the lowest concentration of antibiotic that blocks cell growth. I show you the data just to show you that we do recover nearly 100,000-fold difference between the top and the bottom, and also to show you that there's only very limited experimental error. That's good because one of the many things I'm not is a statistician. So the signal needs to be strong for me to be happy.
Are these mutations on a suite of genes?
No, I'm sorry.
Internal to a single gene?
This is all within a single gene. I should have made that clear. These four are missense mutations. So this is the residue number, and this is the wild type amino acid, and this is the mutant amino acid. Okay. This is a non-coding mutation that's 10 or 12 nucleotides upstream of the start codon and increases expression by about a factor of two. All in the same gene, on a plasmid in this case. 10WT is commonly called AMPR. This is a cloning plasmid that we worked with, and the starting point is an allele that's very good against ampicillin, but terrible against this other drug. And in fact, interestingly, this mutation, which has the largest effect, is the largest and strongly beneficial effect, is detrimental against ampicillin, which is a...
So the fact that you have this cisregular mutation, does this mean that the mutational space is not unique in the sense that any other mutation increasing expression would do the same thing, or is there something special about this one?
My intuition is to say any other mutation that increased expression would do the same thing. But that's just an example of the fact that the mapping from genotype space to phenotype is not one-to-one.
And as you do the experiments, there are presumably other mutations going on that you don't know about.
No, there are no experiments going on because we reverse engineered, we used reverse genetics to put these mutations in and then immediately assay resistance.
The assay is done in a short time scale.
Yes, there's no culturing. There's no culturing. We build the thing, we sequence it, we put it in the freezer.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's, I mean, it's possible there are mutations, but I don't think so. This is the crystal structure of the protein. You can see the four missense mutations relative to the active site. An active area of research of which, and we're making small efforts or small progress in this area, I'll allude to in a few minutes, is to study the protein biology of this thing. How is it that these mutations affect resistance, affect their change on resistance? Now, among these five mutations, four exhibit sign epistasis. So here are the five mutations again, and here are the number of genetic backgrounds on which the effect is positive, negative, or negligible. And there are some limitations to our ability to measure differences between resistance when two alleles are fairly close. So we have some that we have to regard effectively as neutral, but clearly there are lots of numbers here less than 16. And as a consequence, taking these data at face value, there's sharp constraint in the number of trajectories that lead from, that natural selection could follow from 10WT to 10 star. There are five mutations, which defines 120 trajectories, if you don't count reversions and other pathologies. And of those, only 18 have the property that drug resistance goes up at every step. And moreover, by making this assumption that there's that the rank of resistance is the same as rank of fitness, and then making some guesstimate about the distribution of fitness effects, here using extreme value theory, which may or may not be the best guess, we can compute the probability of realization of all trajectories, again, assuming strong selection mutation. So we imagine, we start at 10WT, and we ask what's the probability of fixation of each of the first mutations. And then from each of those, we ask what's the probability of the next mutation. We just multiply those probabilities together. And we get this sharp bias in realization. All 120 trajectories are shown here in decreasing order of probability. You see that from 19 onward, it's zero. But even among the first 18, there's a sharp bias of probability.
It's strong selection, weak mutation, and weak genetic drift as well?
No genetic drift. Yeah. Yeah. And so you might ask what happens.
Not no genetic drift, because presumably the reason for these probabilities is that they go down is because large effect initial mutations are expected to do better, right?
Yes.
So there is some genetic drift.
There is some stochasticity.
So you have some extinction probability which depends on the effect.
Well, no, he's assuming one mutation comes in after the other.
Yeah, so the I start here, and some S1 here, and some S2 here, and actually only two steps, then the then in the simplest sense, the probability of going this way is just S1 over S1 plus S2.
Population size
is not there. Yeah, probability of fixation is 2S. And you might ask, what would happen if I allow population size to go down from infinity? And of course, what happens? Well, with infinite population size, it looks like this. And with population size of 1, I'm sorry, it's absolutely flat. With infinite population size, it looks like this. And with population size of 1, it looks like this. And with intermediate population sizes, it does something intermediate. Yeah, but we skipped all that. And we were pretty excited about this, maybe a little bit too excited about it, and wanted to find a nice hook to get into what someone last week called one of the weeklies. And this is where we pitched it. We described this as reruns on the mutational type of life. Now, I'm with friends, or at least people with whom I feel obliged to be honest with. And I want to make it clear that this is not the same, quite the same thing as what Gould meant about the type of life. Gould imagined, asked the question after some great worldwide cataclysmic extinction, if we had two such extinctions happening at the same place, doing exactly the same thing, would we expect to see the same lineages grow out over the next hundreds of millions of years? And here, as I've already acknowledged, this framework presumes a fixed endpoint and asks whether it would reach the same endpoint by the same path. Gould allows is asking whether it would get to the same endpoint or not. So it's not really apples to apples.
But what I do not understand, if you rerun this experiment again, would you recover? It's just my ignorance. Would you recover the same 5 mutations? Is it kind of, can you find another set of mutations which will confer resistance to this? What surprises me is that there are only 5 mutations which confer resistance to this particular other antibiotic. I forgot the name. Is that correct statement that if you rerun this experiment, you will recover the same 5 mutations? There will be no other mutations which come up, which arise to accommodate for this other antibiotic.
Our experiment began with a published report that a particular set of 5 mutations give this tremendous effect. And we didn't do any forward evolution. We simply used those data, constructed all combinations of those 5 mutations, and made those measurements. That original experiment was one of hundreds, if not thousands, that have used mutagenic PCR against this allele to look for high resistance variants against this drug, and this seems to be the best. But if you did what ought to be done, what Dmitry Petrov is talking about doing, if you did what ought to be done, which is to take my starting allele and challenge it with ever higher concentrations of antibiotic and ask what does it actually do, now we come into the richer problem of having unconstrained endpoints. This is, as because of the clinical importance of this gene, there are databases in which people track mutations that appear clinically. The enzyme is a typical enzyme of 300 residues or something like that, and there have been clinically important mutations at 75 or 100 of them. Now, that's against the whole panoply of beta-lactam antibiotics, and I already told you that mutations that are good against one beta-lactam may be sucky against another beta-lactam. So it's not as if there are 100 mutations that would be good against this drug, but I'm sure there are lots of mutations beyond these 5 that would be good against this drug.
So one can imagine starting not with your wild-type allele, but with a mutation that, according to this list, is a bad direction to go into, and then ask whether it will follow a low probability trajectory according to this list, or we'll find a high probability trajectory
that
is not on this list.
That maybe goes in some completely different direction. Yeah.
The rescue may be another direction.
That's correct. Yeah.
Another interesting element of this, it seems to, I mean, these are all questions about what other paths there may be, which is sort of about the dimensionality of the space. But it might also be interesting to think about in the absence of the drug, presumably some of these mutations are deleterious, and by different degrees and different combinations are more or less deleterious. And so, you know, there might be a sort of interesting seascape set of questions, essentially, where if you have different sort of time dependence of the fitness function by different sort of time dependence of the concentration of the drug, including periods where it's zero, you could presumably completely reorder the probability that you will follow any of these paths by, you know, changing the time which you would be in states which are deleterious in one or the other environment.
Yeah. So a couple empirical facts, and really this is Jeff's work, but in his hands there's no cost to resistance. Except for the cost of the carriage of the plasmid, there's no cost to resistance in the absence of the drug. And what he's done since then, and sadly he didn't talk about it, from my point of view, sadly he didn't talk about it, is to invert the or put these same alleles under quite a different selective regime and ask about reversibility. So in there he has implicitly a toggling environment, and we're just about. Let me just press on slide after this. I'll have a few more things to say about that. So we might ask about generality, which results. Within a gene, there seems to be considerable sign epistasis. The first study of this sort was an isopropyl malate dehydrogenase by Tony's group. More recently, Elena Lazowski and colleagues in Dan Harrell's group studied an enzyme called the hydrofolate reductase, which mutations in which confer resistance to antifolates in malaria. There's deliciously elegant work coming out of Joe Thornton's group studying ancestral hormone receptors. One question I might ask is, what about working on a structural gene? And the model that I know of that surely has fatal limitations, but it's certainly intriguing, is human beta tubulin mutations in which, so beta tubulin polymerizes and depolymerizes very transiently and is important in mitosis, moving organelles around during mitosis. And Taxol, which is a very important anti-cancer drug, screws up the polymerization of beta tubulin, but mutations in beta tubulin render cells immune to that drug pressure. It's about 10 mutations, as I understand it. So that sounds like a pretty exciting substrate.
These ones are all very strong. Sort of very focused selection.
So these studies.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess the ones on the bottom are not so much. I mean, the one of the strong example I think is yeast under pretty low glucose. Do you know the numbers in Gavin Sherlock's?
The percentage glucose, I think, is actually quite low percentage.
So it's dividing every four or five hours. I forgot.
No, it's like two and a half or something.
Because they see the first mutations that come in. There's two of them, different ones, each of which confer 40% gain in growth rate. If you have the two together, it's minus 40%.
Yeah, I think I've
heard. The logic of that, you know, when people thought they understood yeast, the logic of it was far from obvious. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we as a community are just scratching the surface. There are lots of dimensions that haven't been explored, and I want to be very clear that forward evolution experiments are frustrating to me because they take a long time, but that doesn't make them uninteresting. I think perhaps just the opposite. So we do have some data between genes. There seems to be less sign epistasis. That was one of the punchlines of Chris's talk last week. In his bugs that eat methane, there's very little, if any, sign epistasis. Very little, if any, sign epistasis among the first few mutations found in one of the Lenski lines. That reverse genetic exercise has been done by Tim Cooper in Houston. Isabel Gordo, who will be here in a few weeks, has a very nice study in which she asked about epistasis between mutations in different genes that confer resistance to different antibiotics. There is some sign epistasis there. One thing I'd be interested in is not one gene, not the whole genome, but here these are two genes, these are two enzymes that interact to give antifolate resistance in malaria. So Lazowski and colleagues did a study in VHFR, and I actually had a hand in designing some of that work. And my suggestion was there are also clinically important mutations in a second enzyme called dihydroterate synthase, DHPS, which confer heightened resistance to the same drug. So what about epistasis between mutations in those two genes? Let's ask about the sign epistasis here as a function of this background.
The drug resistance ones, some of Roy Tishoni's experiments with lots of different pairs of drugs where you find some number of them, I think it's a small number, where the effect of the two antibiotics together, they're less effective than either one.
Right, right. Roy's done some really elegant work in which he's taken the notion of epistasis between mutations and asked about interactions between drugs. And has shown both theoretically and experimentally that two drugs which interact synergistically, which means you don't need as much of the two together as you would have guessed, so that's a good thing clinically. That same circumstance makes the opportunity of resistance evolution, that heightens the opportunity for resistance evolution.
But then he actually argues that the thing which is bad clinically, which is where the two drugs together are antagonistic. It's then that's good, because then you have to get over the
exactly.
So have you seen the more complex motif called, sometimes called reciprocal sign epistasis?
Yes. So reciprocal sign epistasis means that for each of two mutations, singly they're deleterious, but jointly they're beneficial, or the other way around. And that's necessary for multiple maxima on the landscape. And that was observed in this system. The reason I did my study is because, if we have time at the very end, I'm going to talk about some very elementary theory that we did on the population process of crossing fitness valleys. And so I wanted a fitness valley in my hands that I could then do some forward evolution on. I actually, since I've been interrupted, I'm going to interrupt you guys and go back and say something I forgot to say, which is that whether you think the question of multiple maxima on a landscape is an important or interesting question or not, my conclusion on appreciating the importance of sign epistasis is to realize that there's really a continuum. There are landscapes that are very smooth, that have no epistasis whatsoever, or at least that have no sign epistasis, and what that means is every mutation is either beneficial or deleterious on every background. And you don't need much help. Darwin doesn't need much help to make that go. And at the other extreme, you might have a random landscape like the NK with K equals N minus 1, where every fitness value, every line in the table is IID. And in between, there's a continuum, and it's much richer than just is it single peaked or multi-peaked. So you can have sign epistasis, as in my data, which can reduce the number of trajectories that are available to you without eliminating them altogether. Yes, Boris.
You quarrel with that, of course. But this slide in particular, so one thing is not clear to me is, you want to investigate the extent, how common sign epistasis is. But the question is, is it physiological epistasis that you study in the sense of computer science? You sort of started out with, I guess biologists would say, sort of complete library of some random ones and zeros, mm-hmm. and you assign a function to every combination, right? And now, in principle, we just do 2 to the billion
experiments,
and we're all set, right?
Yep.
So now, evolution actually is doing that experiment. It's just probing these different alleles one at a time, and to some extent, it's evolving in this gigantic landscape that we can't quite describe. So we can do a little experiment, right, with a little library, but it will be unbiased. Some set of mutations that, conceivably, you'll find this or that level of epistasis. Now, on the other hand, if you take mutations from some hospital isolates, you are not really sampling epistasis, so physiological epistasis, right? This is epistasis in some standing population somewhere, and that already reflects the fact that it's easier to find paths in that space which all go up. So you're going to find typically less epistasis. Mm-hmm. because those mutations that tend to take you through the rugged landscape realm will never make it.
It's sort of the anthropic principle that I mentioned earlier.
But, you mean if you look at the very you look at the diversity in these? What do you mean by looking at the epistasis in the hospital?
You can't interrupt the interrupt. Sorry. So somehow the answer to the question that's being asked here depends a little bit on where you get the mutations that you're going to study. So for example, if you take these mutations from completely different isolates, different hospital, right? And now you start combining them, you might want some different answer here, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. No question.
But that's why when you say when you take things from the hospital, you find the epistasis from them. But this is assuming that you disentangle all of the mutations by which the two strains differ from each other. Or these are strains which differ by only one or two mutations.
Well, I guess all I'm trying to say is if one studies the five mutations that arose in one bug, which evolved with these five mutations, or you take three mutations from one bug in one hospital, and the three mutations in some completely, completely different
realization,
you may find a different answer.
Would you also discover they differ by much more than three mutations?
Well, precisely. So I guess what I'm trying to say is what one studies in this small system, right? So a few mutations in one nice gene is not quite the same thing that what you find generically when you take two diverged strains of yeast and just smash them together and look at lots of
So you're saying epistasis around the ridges is expected to be less than somewhere else.
Yeah, I think it's making two points. One is epistasis among mutations that were realized that were driven by natural selection will be less likely to have captured in one population, in one realization, will have less epistasis than perhaps random mutations will. And two, in any natural realization, there will be thousands or hundreds of thousands of mutations that have occurred, and to try to make any sense in this context of those thousands of mutations is impractical. So here are some limitations. First of all, I've assumed throughout strong selection and mutation, and so people in this, including several in this room, have made breathtakingly elegant contributions here. We can now no longer represent populations by single point, and so I defer to others. This is one of the two points that Boris just made. As the size of the problem grows, as the size of the problem grows, the size of the experiment grows exponentially. And it's in the same vein, predictions about particular realizations are conditioned on that small, examining a small space and maybe fixing the endpoint. And then this is the thing that we talked about some minutes ago, varying environment, and that includes frequency dependence. Now, one faint hope, which fits to some extent in the way Jeff thinks about the some of his work, we can encode a discrete environment in the fitness function. I mean, we just add columns at the left end for all the different environments that you'd like. It has to be an environment that you can encode in a discrete way. It can't be a continuous measure of temperature. But if you cycle between ampicillin and piperacillin, or whatever the other drug that Jeff uses, I think Michael also talked about some kind of time-dependent, but somewhat well-defined discrete number of environments, we can handle that. We can describe the same surface, the same function, and then, again, subject to strong selection mutation, we can make progress.
That's assuming the environment that you're setting rather than the microbes are setting it for each other.
Mea culpa. I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. And the problem with that is to extend the analogy from loci to environments, we have a model for how loci change. We have some notion of how mutations happen, starting with their time scale. And you need something analogous to play the role of a mutational model with respect to changing environment. Go ahead, Michael.
I just wanted to make a speculation on this, which is, we've been talking a lot about epistasis, which is kind of the effect of mutations in different backgrounds and mm-hmm. sign epistasis and mm-hmm. so on. And when we start thinking about sort of varying environments, maybe there's a sort of similar concept of essentially the correlation and fitnesses between environment of given genetic, given genotypes between backgrounds, which I guess people sort of related to pleiotropy, and whether there's a concept of sort of sign pleiotropy across some range of environments. Or
I wouldn't call it.
Yeah, I know it's not really.
I'm not sure. A pleiotropy to me means a mutation affects more than one trait, and now a trait could be fitness in environment one or environment two, but that's right. not what they typically use. But the short answer is what you say generalizes immediately that yes. Mutations that are beneficial in one background but deleterious in others suffer the same problems as mutations that are beneficial in one genetic background as others. And there's an exact analog to sign epistasis. In fact, quantitative geneticists talk about G by E interactions, and they talk about crossing G by E interactions, that is to say, reactions whose lines cross as you move. So here's environment one, here's environment two, here's genotype one, here's genotype two, and they cross. And that's been appreciated for a long time. It's direct analog there.
Yeah, for example, there are examples of mutations which are beneficial at low temperature and detrimental at high temperature.
For example. Okay. So that's the end of part one. Part two, environmental and cellular architecture. So this is at the lowest level. This is asking the question, what's the biology that gives rise to these topographic features on the fitness landscape that we've just spent 45 minutes exploring. And I want to say something that comes out very strongly in a review a couple years ago by Tony Dean and Joe Thornton, which is, and this is a remark that's addressed to the biologists perhaps more than the physicists, this is, it's incumbent on us as biologists, as evolutionary biologists, to pursue this, they argue, that in some sense, many of our non-evolutionary biology colleagues have been scratching their heads about us for some years. What's all this neutrality selection bullshit? Where's the biology? And I think that's a fair critique. I got interested.
Where's the biology in knockouts?
Fair enough. I'm not saying we can solve the world's problems. I mean, we can't solve that problem. But I think we have an opportunity to connect important insights from evolutionary biology to mechanistic parts of biology. And I'm interested in pursuing that. And that was one of the points of this recent review by Dean and Thornton. So I'm going to talk a little bit about protein biology of beta-lactamase. This is actually where the lion's share of work in my lab has gone in the last couple of years. This is work that my postdoc, Jen Kinesis, has been working on. And we've purified all the protein-coding alleles. We've measured their kinetics, and we've measured their melting temperature. And as you'll see in a minute, we think those are important traits. And what we'd like to, well, you'll see why we're doing that in a minute. I'm going to then sketch very new work that I'm interested in getting off the ground this semester. Characterizing mutational effect on life history of this bacteriophage, PHI-X174, in terms of its more mechanistic constituents. And finally, a couple of theory ideas that I've been playing with that try to, from first principles, say something about how what things we maybe believe we know about the mechanisms of biology might be reflected in the topology of fitness landscapes. And we recently got funded for these two things, so that's actually quite exciting. Okay, so here's the beta-lactamase protein evolution story, protein biology story. We've ignored the interior of the cell, so E. coli is a black box, and I inserted 16 different protein coding alleles and read out 16 different resistances. There are 32 alleles that in total, but one of them was a promoter mutation. Well, I guess we can say I fed in 32 alleles and read out 32 resistances, but mutational effect on resistance is surely mediated by some one or more of these mechanistic intermediates. The gene is transcribed and translated and folds. It has to be translocated in this case and folds into its native form and has to do its hydrolysis thing, and there are lots of other things that can go wrong. And every one of those arrows is a rate, and every one of those nodes is a concentration that in principle may change with mutation. And so the kind of the overarching idea here is, can we model drug resistance evolution in terms of proximal biochemical mechanisms? And the fantasy is that we can arrange all the alleles here, so this is now, again, the hypercube, and then we could measure or even predict levels of message for each allele based on what we understand about transcription rate and concentration of protein, based on what we know about translation rate, the degradation rate, blah, 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 blah. So on the left, we've done the work in the fantasy. We've done the work experimentally at the bench. And on the right, we've written principled equations that make predictions, and we try to match the two of those together.
So that's like systems biology.
That could be. Yeah, I don't really know. So I'm just going to show you some data that most of them aren't even ours, but they sort of point the way that we're proceeding. This is, of course, a big famous boosterism, quote, boosterism of my intellectual grandfather, Fedosey Dobzhansky. My friend and our colleague Tony Dean turned that on its head 10 years ago and said nothing in evolution makes sense except in the light of biology, and that's sort of preaching this point that evolutionary biologists might be well advised not to entirely forget about the biology. So this is a figure, these are my data. So what I'm showing you here are two single missense mutations, and their combo. And on the y-axis, I'm showing you their drug resistance normalized by that of the wild type. So 238S increases resistance, this is log scale. So 238 increases resistance 20-fold, M182P reduces resistance 10-fold, and the double mutant has about a 200-fold increase in resistance. So this is an example of sine epistasis, because 182T reduces resistance on the wild type, but improves it on the 238S background. And these are data from another group some years ago in which they characterized the kinetics of the enzyme and the folding stability for each allele. And so what you see is 238S increases activity, but at the expense of stability. M182T reduces activity, but gains stability. And together, then, it's like two great tastes that go great together. They each, in some sense, offset the deficit of the other. And interestingly, there's no sine epistasis in these other traits. So 238S is unconditionally good with respect to activity and unconditionally bad with respect to stability, and M182T is the other. And so this is these these are the sorts of experiments that we're doing for all 16 protein coding alleles, measuring. We in fact nearly have these data together, the KCAT and KM and delta delta G for each mutation, and we'd like to see. This is just a qualitative characterization, right? That I say to you, see how the deficits of this mutation are largely offset by this to give this nice effect. We'd like to see whether we can extend that to the other alleles, and then we'd also like to be rather quantitative about it. So I recently learned this is called the embarrassed to say in this room. I recently learned this is called the Fermi equation, which tells you the
fraction. Fermi function.
Function. Thank you. I just now learned it's called the Fermi function, which tells you the fraction of molecules that are in the catalytically active state as a function of the difference in free energy between the folded and unfolded forms. And this is, I've known for some years, it's called the Michaelis-Menten equation, which relates enzyme and substrate concentration together with catalytic properties. On the one hand, to the hydrolytic velocity. And so we might reason that resistance is going to be proportional to this product. And we are measuring this, this, and this.
And what is the relation between Km and beta lactam? What is greater, Km or beta lactam, or concentration of beta lactam? So in which regime is that? Is it a saturation of substrate, or it's saturation of the enzyme, or enzyme concentration? Because
I understand, enzyme. We believe enzyme. But I'm now right at the frontier of what I'm comfortable saying in front of a crowd, but I'd be delighted to talk to you about it later. But that is the way we're doing the math.
Because then kind of the effect would be very different, because whether it's K-keto or KM,
doesn't matter.
It depends on this relation.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very important in
yep.
this mutation.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about that. You have another week here?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, we'll talk
about
it. And I'll show some data tomorrow about it.
Wonderful. Okay, so that's what we're doing with protein biology, and I won't say more because the data aren't in and they're not my data, they're those of my postdoc. And I want to instead switch gears and talk about something you haven't heard anything about, no one's heard anything about. Well, I guess I presented it at Michigan State last month, but it's a brand new project for me, working in the bacteriophage PhiX174. This is a picture of not PhiX174. But the phage are metabolically inert little packages of DNA which adsorb to the surface of their host cell, inject their DNA, and then co-opt the cell's metabolism to make lots of copies of them. And they've been known for nearly 100 years. They were instrumental in the birth of molecular biology, first genome sequenced, and also, interestingly for the ecologist, they're key top-down regulators of marine microbes. They're very important ecological players in the ocean.
So what are we looking at? Is that phage lattice?
It's one of the T's. It's E. coli, one of the T's. Could be. Honestly, I don't remember. You know how it is with Google search. This is a picture of the T4 life cycle, but it's true for all lytic phage. The phage adsorbs to the surface of the host cell. They inject their DNA. The viral proteins then are expressed using the host's ribosome and so on. Baby viruses are put together, and eventually the cell bursts out and releases 10 or 100 or 1,000 phage particles. And a few years ago, Jim Bull wrote this equation at the top. Growth rate of a population of phage will follow this form, where the key parameters from our point of view are adsorption rate of phage onto host cells, burst size of phage, how many phage come out per generation, and lag time, how long it takes for that to happen. And so you could imagine, and this is a system that Jim and his students have studied a lot, allowed to evolve in the laboratory populations a la Galinsky lines, and done lots of interesting ecological studies as well. You can imagine that mutations that affect growth rate are bound to do it by mediation through one of these quantities. So this equation is like the equations I put up a minute ago.
What is little d?
Little d the big C is the host cell concentration, and little d is the host cell death rate, and X is the phage death rate. These are the phage variables, and we can imagine holding these constant because we're going to imagine re-inoculating a naive host population. So these are the things that maybe will influence growth rate. And I've particularly gotten interested in measuring these things, and now I'll tell you the truth. I've gotten interested in measuring them because I like doing the experiments, and I haven't exactly figured out quite why it's so important, but the experiments are elegant and interesting, and so I'm just going to show you how we're doing that and be delighted to talk to people.
This all assumes the phage is, there's no co-infection?
Yes. Yes, that's probably true. Yeah, I don't know about this phage. The phage I know a lot better, Phi6, that we heard something about at the beginning of the week, has the property that it's that multiple infections are limited, that you can't get in, that for reasons that aren't understood, if multiplicity infection is 1,000, you still only get infected by 2 or 3 phage. It's not limited to one, but it's not as if there's this big orgy of 100 genotypes taking advantage of each other.
Is it that they put you only 3 of them come out, or only 3 get in?
Oh no, only 3 get in. Because if in the media there's a big orgy of phage with lots of different genotypes, and then you look and see what comes out, you can show that the number that come out are a product of at most 2 or 3 that went.
That's different. I mean, it could be 100 go in, but only the first 2 or 3 are successful, and the other ones don't produce them; they're unproductive. There's a separation between what goes in and the productivity.
Yes, but it seems to me that, well, I guess I'm not 100%, you're absolutely right, Daniel. I'm not sure whether Michael's question was, is there a great deal of genetic recombination, and in which case the answer is no, but your point is that if you're infected by phage, even if none of those come out, that infection may screw up the fitness of the ones that do come out. They may consume host resources, for example. Anyways, the way we're doing the experiment, we're holding multiplicity infection far below 1, so this is moot. Okay? So these are the things we're interested in. And people have been measuring these quantities for many years. These are data that Jen and I put together. And what you do is you take a culture of host cells and you add 10 to the 4th phage. And then at intervals, you sample from the culture and you just count how many phage are there. Now normalize with the number you put in. And this is experimental noise, and we typically think of this as some kind of sigmoidal curve, although I acknowledge there isn't actually a data point to pin that in the middle. It could have been a step function, but it surely wasn't.
And why did you choose, you chose 5x174 because it's a very short genome and just a couple
of... It chose 5x174 because it's 5,000 bases and we can do reverse genetics. And we had it in the lab. And Art Poon, who's a colleague of mine and a former student of Lin's, had done some work that motivated us, although we're not, in the end, going to use his lines for
reasons. And that has low mutation rate. Is that true? Because people kind of sort of, different people argue about mutation rate of this phage.
This phage...
Does it have low mutation rate like Drake Rules 0.03 or it's higher?
Golly, now I have to do exponents on my feet. What I can tell you is it uses the host's polymerase. So it has a low genomic mutation rate.
So small kit doesn't bring in its own.
Yes, that's correct. Exactly. Yep. So anyways, you look at a plot like this, and if you knew exactly where this transition was, you could estimate average lag time in the culture to be this and average burst size in the culture to be this. And somehow I decided I wanted to not measure averages, but to get a sample of lag time and burst size. And so that meant I want to characterize those dynamics for a single phage, for a single particle. So this is the thought experiment. I inoculate host cells with one phage, and I ask how many are in the culture now. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. At some moment, it jumps to 100, 300, 300, 300, 300, 303. That moment is the moment that the host bursts, and that number, 103, is the burst size. The challenge in doing this thus far is that we can't do this sort of sampling without being destructive. We have a culture with a bunch of host cells and one phage. The only way to know how many phage are in there is to destroy the culture, to take the volume of the culture and put it on a plate and ask how many plaques we see. And that
there's no number of phages, it's PFUs.
Yes. It's not number of phages, it's PFUs. That's right, plaque-forming units. So if you think that's important, I'd like to offline hear about why and how we might fix that.
But before you count platform units, you're doing this in a well-stirred?
The previous figure was from well-stirred data. And so what we do instead is we take a 96-well plate and we put 100 microliters of host cell, and then we put in what we believe is an average of a half a phage particle per well, and every 30 seconds we titer the total number of phage in the next well. So we're destructively sampling, and so we recognize that we have 60 independent realizations of some one process. That's what we think we have. And these are what typical data look like. So on the x-axis is the time at which I took the sample, and on the y-axis the number of PFUs in the well. And you see for a long time there's nothing much happening. It's a bunch of zeros and ones, as you'd hope. And then at some moment you start to see some numbers that are bigger than zero or one. And so this is some estimate of minimum lag time. But of course, observation that there are 150 phage in the well at this moment, 22 minutes in, doesn't tell me it burst at 22 minutes. It only tells me that it burst before that. Whoops. And there are also some wells late in the experiment that still only have one or two phage, only one or two PFUs in them, which signals that there's some high variance in this time.
Well, but didn't you say you put in half of a phage per well? So some of them should have zero.
Yeah. Yeah. There are lots of zeros in here.
Right. I guess I'm saying that if you see a zero down there, it doesn't mean that...
This isn't a zero. This is a one.
Oh.
Yeah, no question. There's still lots of zeros. Mm. That's a one.
Right.
There's also, now that's to get to the question of the Poisson problem, that's the input is roughly Poisson distributed, and so here are the data blown up to the last moment before we see something bigger than 0 or 1 or 2. And you see there's lots of zeros and fewer ones and fewer twos and 1, 3. But given that level of variance on the input side, there's apparently to the ocular test, the high variance on the output side. It's not as if there were clear bands at burst and two burst and three burst. It's a big smear as far as we can tell.
And the fitness of this virus would be some composite of the lag time and the burst size? You want short lag time, high burst size?
Yes. 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 And we believe that. So here's a place where I'm happy to use the word pleiotropy. We believe from data, our own and others, that mutations will affect more than one of these traits, and you can easily see why that might be. And how those things relate is given perhaps by this equation here. Okay. So this is all I have to say on this topic, just to point out that there is, to my mind, an interesting quantitative problem that I haven't yet solved, and if somebody suddenly sees the answer, I'd be delighted to talk about it. How do we estimate these two quantities from these two distributions? We don't know whether this was the output from one phage or two phage or three phage. We don't know when it happened, except that it had already happened by now. So what I'd like to do is find a way to do this non-destructively, and my fantasy is that that someone will be able to sell me a label that sticks only to free phage coats. And so the idea is then it'll only stick and it'll only stick to free phage and it'll only fluoresce when it's stuck. And so the first piece is easy, the second piece is harder. And so then the idea is, and it can't interfere with the biology in these wells. Then the idea is I add a bunch of this dye. At the beginning, the signal is very weak because there's one phage coat in there. And at some moment, the signal suddenly goes way up because the host cell has just burst. And that tells me the when. And then it's easy enough to do the controlled experiments and figure out how to read out the how many from the how strong.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to deconvolute that for the Poisson. That's true.
Good. I thought this might be a good audience to pitch it to. So maybe somebody wants to spend a little bit of time with me. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about phage. That's all I'm going to say about experiments at this lower level of how to think about the topographic features of fitness landscapes. I'm now going to present stuff that some of you saw a year and a half ago at the Gordon conference, in which we've been using Fisher's geometric model to try to make a principled attack at what we think the patterns of epistasis on a fitness landscape would be, are actually a more focused question, which is how can we use Fisher's model to say something interesting from data on epistatic interactions between pairs of mutations? Because as you can see, measuring epistasis between pairs of mutations is something that we're not that bad at doing. So to quickly review for you Fisher's geometric model of adaptation, this is another kind of fitness landscape I'm now going to introduce, where the independent variable is some kind of high-dimensional space that describes the phenotype of the organism. So this is not projected over genotype space, and surely there's going to be some non-trivial relationship from one to the other. And we imagine then that there are some number of traits or phenotypes that define the space, and there's some optimal value for each of these traits. And importantly, though not often acknowledged, we assume that there's no interaction between what's optimal for these traits, so that we can simply ask what value of phenotype 1 is optimal and call that the zero point on that axis, what value of phenotype 2 is optimal and call that the zero point on that axis, and then at the origin of the space, we find the phenotypic combination that's optimal all the way around. Fitness then is some declining function from the origin, and for Fisher's purposes and ours as well, because we don't know how to do better, we assume that this fitness surface is rotationally symmetrical. And imagine an organism which phenotype is given here, and here's a mutation. It's beneficial because it moves in closer toward the origin. Fisher was a big advocate for the unimportance of epistasis. I didn't know the man, if he was like me, he will have felt that way, because epistasis so completely would have complicated his mathematics. At least he would have felt in part that way, because epistasis would have so completely complicated his mathematics, not unlike the way I'm trying to use one hammer to solve problems that maybe don't fit that well to it. But all that notwithstanding, this model of adaptation that he offered is rife with epistasis. So here's the same mutation on a different phenotypic background, and here it's deleterious, just as an aside. And that's nice, because we see lots of sign epistasis. In fact, it's sign epistatic, and we see lots of sign epistasis in the antibiotic story, and that's what motivates this work here. So we assume for the purpose of this work, all traits under stabilizing selection and all mutations are pleiotropic. That is to say, nearly all mutations are pleiotropic, which means that they don't lie parallel to any one axis. They perturb more than one trait, which is odd.
How many dimensions are you going to be in?
We're going to tell you how many dimensions there are. By analyzing data. That's correct. And we're not the first in that. The first attempt at that I'm aware of came from Lynn's lab. using an equation that the same student Arapoon developed in his master's that relates equilibrium, population equilibrium fitness to dimensionality of the underlying organism as a function of population size. And actually, Olin, you contributed that paper as well. So populations were grown to a fitness equilibrium subject to the claim that there are no grown to the mutation selection equilibrium as a function of population size, and how far down you go as population size goes down was thought to give insight into the number of dimensions. So this interest for me was motivated by this paper that Mark DiPristo wrote with a little bit of help from me, in which he brought the facts of protein biology to the table for the delectation of evolutionary biologists. And the main points were, one, that a protein to contribute to the organism has to do whatever it is its name reflects, its name suggests, bind to its binding target, catalyze its reaction, but it has to do some other things that all proteins have to do, like fold into its native form, not be aggregated, not be degraded prematurely, and mutations will influence all of these traits. Intermediate trait values for many of these traits are often optimal. This is called stabilizing selection, and most mutations influence more than one trait, i.e. they act pleiotropically. And so this has all the elements of Fisher's model. And so this figure you've already seen, this is the relationship between resistance and resistance in green on the one hand, and stability and activity in pink and purple on the other. And here we now name the axes stability and activity. And here is a cartoon of what the two-thirded S mutation might do. It improves activity, but at the cost of stability. Here's a cartoon of what the stabilizing M1A2T mutation does. It increases stability, but at the cost of activity. And here they are together, somehow offsetting each other's deficits. It's a cartoon. But it motivates me to think about a little bit more quantitatively about what I would get out of Fisher's model. In particular, what would I expect in the abstract if I now accept Fisher's model and I learn something about epistatic interactions? What can I say about the geometry of the underlying space? What can we learn from epistasis between two deleterious mutations? So here, imagine an organism at the optimum, at some kind of optimal phenotype. And here's one deleterious mutation, and here's a second deleterious mutation. And here are the two deleterious mutations together. And note that I've introduced the notion of an angle, of the angle between the two deleterious mutations. And this space may be of high dimensionality, but I'm only any two vectors that originate from a point define a plane, so I can compute that angle. I can talk about that angle. And here are the same two. Here are two mutations that have the same deleterious effect, but they have quite a different angle between them, and the consequence is that their interactions are quite different. And so the intuitive notion is, can we work backwards from this framework? Can I say something about the fitness effect of two deleterious mutations singly and together that will give me inferences into the angle between, and from there into the number of dimensions that are occupied by these vectors?
We're
presuming to start out at the peak. That's correct. Yeah. And the answer is yes, subject to a couple perhaps draconian assumptions. One is that fitness is rotationally symmetrical and has this particular form. And the other is more important in some sense, or at least more troubling, perhaps, and that is that the traits are additive in phenotype space, that the only epistasis that we observe is with respect to fitness. Now, that sounds like an odd thing for me to say, in as much as I've just spent 90 minutes singing the importance of epistasis, but there's not bad experimental evidence with respect to proteins, at least, that folding stability are additive, and at least in some cases that kinetics are also additive. And in any case, my view is we need to start somewhere. I think these ideas motivate experiments which will surely challenge the formalism, but that doesn't make it
Are you talking this phenotype in abstract way, or are you thinking about, for example, stability as one axis?
Let's say I'm thinking about stability as one axis.
Yeah, then I would probably strong, though you have some evidence to the opposite, but I have more evidence, I would disagree that there is an optimal stability.
Fair enough. For,
because there is a lot of evidence that there is no such thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
From what experiments? I know what you mean in this, but
I
know the experiments which are hundreds of various kinds
of cases. And that's right. And stability is a problematic trait in this framework, although it, it seems to me you can, in some sense, kludge the thing by just saying that if this, let's imagine phenotype one is stability and this is increasing stability, and this is the point at which you're well up on top of the shoulder now. So, mm-hmm. so no further stability gain is beneficial. That then we can just cut off this
that
space.
Is correct.
And the rest of so.
That's
but
I would agree.
You know, I said a week ago on Tuesday when we introduced ourselves that I'm a hack biologist and a hack mathematician, and I don't. I'm comfortable with that. I think you know this is intriguing to me. I want to see how far we can push it. Okay. So, anyways, if we assume that they're additive and assume that it's Gaussian, we can do some algebra. This is under the model the predicted fitness of the double mutant as a function of the fitness of the two single mutants and the angle between them. That's the unknown. And I can then invert the equation and I get back this thing, which gives me the angle between two mutations in phenotype space as a function of the fitness values in of the single and double mutants, i.e. things I can measure. Now, we're already pretty far in the weeds, in particular because this quantity is only a real number if this is between positive and negative one, and we already have data that don't satisfy that requirement. So I don't want to stand here and say this is a silver bullet. It's rife with problems, but for me at least, it motivates some very interesting thoughts. So anyways, with those kinds of caveats aside, given two mutations marked X and Y, we can use reverse genetics to put X and Y and the double mutant of the wild type. We can do that in beta-lactamase. We can do that in PHI-X174. We can do that in lots of systems. Again, we need to know the mutations that matter, and that's a serious problem, hearkening back to the first part of the talk. And then given those fitness values, we can compute the angle between them. And so here's a matrix of angles between pairs of five mutations. And of course, it's symmetric, so these are the only real data. And what can we do with these data? For pairs of mutations with extreme values of theta, estimated extreme values of theta, namely nearly parallel or nearly anti-parallel, we would infer that they affect the same phenotype. And in beta-lactamase, we can test that, and so that's what we propose to do: is to take pairs of mutations that, according to this algebra, predict very large or very small angles, and then measure those mutations' effect on folding stability, kinetics, and other traits that maybe are important. More interestingly, perhaps, is the case of mutations that are orthogonal to each other, because it means that they're affecting distinct traits, and that hints that we may be able to make some progress on the size of this space. If I, for example, have three mutations and pairwise they're all orthogonal to each other, then we can conclude that they lie in at least three space, because you can't shoehorn three pairs of vectors that are orthogonal to each other onto the plane. And some time ago, some kind mathematicians showed me how to compute this bound on the number of dimensions, regardless of what the angles are, by doing a little bit of linear algebra.
But if you're getting imaginary angles sometimes,
yes,
wouldn't that suggest that maybe this geometrical model is not so useful, and you could just go off and use some other measure of what the interactions between x and y? The fitness of X plus the fitness of Y minus the fitness of the combined. There might be some other dimensionless thing that you don't have to be so hung up at these angles. I guess I'm a little bit puzzled why you're buying in so much.
Well, it's for historical reasons. This is a model that's in currency. But help me to understand a little bit more clearly what you're saying.
It's not at all profound. It's just that, it's like looking at a covariance or something like that in statistics. That there ought to be a dimensionless measure that doesn't have to do with these angles, which can be imaginary. Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly wonderful program experimentally. I'm just saying, why go and buy into these angles? You have a measurement of what happens when you have x plus y. You
yes.
have measurements of x and measurements of y. You should invent your own measure that doesn't have this sickness.
Yeah. It comes from this rotational symmetry that you build in. Now, if you give this up, you have immediate B wall parameters. So maybe as a starting point,
well,
but then if you get these imaginary values, you may
Yeah, well, you also can get imaginary values if it turns out these traits aren't, the underlying traits aren't additive.
I would give up the rotational symmetry. I mean, you can do it this way if you want, but it just seems like you end up...
Why don't just give up the model? I mean, the model's ridiculous.
So I don't dispute that the model is ridiculous, but the problem is the motivation for this model or one like it is that to go into your favorite system and actually characterize these traits is a shitload of work, at least for my group. So whereas we're quite a bit more adept at measuring patterns of epistasis. And so the question comes, what can we do with those data? We've spent 2.5 years learning how to do protein biology, and it's hard. So we need to find colleagues who are motivated to do the work for us. And in the meantime, or instead of, what is there something we can contribute? And maybe the conclusion is this is a dead end.
Well, I think the program is great and wonderful. And I just, maybe you could write a paper saying, well, this Fisher model doesn't work, so we're going to use our own parameterization of the data. That if it's in currency, you can shoot it down, that's a contribution, and you can come up with your own measure.
Yeah, yeah. I guess maybe my problem is very practical, namely, this equation, I couldn't find a way to write this equation after relaxing the assumption of rotational symmetry. That doesn't mean it's not out there, but I mean, as Michael just said, there are a lot more parameters that enter now.
But even
how many measurements do you have? I mean, like in the sense of like how much power would you have to derive a more, you know, complex?
Yes, right. So suppose I said, here's what I can do. I'll measure 10 mutants and all their pairs. So that's 55 experiments, or 12 mutants. Obviously, that number, the amount of work grows fast.
So you're measuring what properties? How many properties is it?
One, some representation of fitness.
But then that should give a bit more information than a simple spherical hat, right? Yeah. So you would have more power, probably.
Good.
But make a ellipsoidal hat with the appropriate number of dimensions.
Why hat? I mean, I just don't.
You don't like that it's a...
Why
you don't like
force it into something which is clearly wrong?
Are you now wrong about it?
That there's a peak?
Yeah, there's a peak that way that things are smoother on it and so on.
Yeah, the things are Gaussian. I mean, why the hell should they be Gaussian?
Well, I mean,
of course you can assume anything, but at the end of the day you get complex numbers. I mean, that's...
All right. You, but at the end of the day, if you can assume anything in a d-dimensional space, then you can't, then...
I'm just trying to understand what's being done here, right? So your measurements are fitness, right? And you want to infer something about phenotypes. Mm-hmm. So you haven't measured anything about phenotypes yet.
That's correct.
So there is no way you can predict anything about phenotypes without making an assumption about it.
Yes.
You happen to make an assumption that it's a simple Gaussian landscape.
Yes.
On the basis of that, you're making a prediction about phenotypes.
Yes.
So now, if your prediction somehow, presumably falsifiable, right? Mm-hmm. So if you prove it right, you know, we'll have to say, well, either your model is justified, or
there
is a zillion other models that will give exactly the same result.
Yes.
But we can't really ask you to say, forget any model of phenotype, just analyze the raw data and tell us something about the phenotype. There's no information there about the phenotype without the model.
Yeah.
Right? But we can quibble about the space of these phenotypic models and how sensitive your test is of this or that model.
Yeah, so that's the kind of interruption that I like.
I guess to me that the most sort of striking limitation of this model is that it's sort of, you make a mapping between sort of the sequences, and then there comes these phenotypes, the phenotypes, and then there is fitness. And you say it's completely additive at stage two.
Yes.
So all this epistasis is played on the first part of the mapping.
Yes.
And I don't see an a priori reason why this should be.
Yeah.
So to me, the minimal extension of this model would be something that defines the proper normal coordinates around this maximum, i.e. something that allows also for a little bit of epistasis between the traits.
Mm-hmm. Why do you want to define around a maximum? Why do you think you're anywhere near a maximum?
Because probably that's even easy experimentally to assess that you're sort of at some local maximum, right? I mean, that should be something that...
I mean, lots and lots of mutations have been put into beta-lactamase looking for things that are better than MyTEM star with respect to cefotaxime resistance. None have been found.
And if it's qualitative traits, why not a maximum? I mean, they have a maximum possibly somewhere, right? And
because you're looking at the total number of mutations is very small.
Yeah. And what about getting a collaborator who can help you measure the phenotype to this protein so you can actually measure the stability and the activity?
Yeah.
And
then you can, I'm all for it. Yeah. I'm all for it. But that's
whether it's linear.
That's right. But in other organisms, the decomposition of fitness into the mechanistic traits is going to be challenging. So this is meant to be a way to kind of begin to get your arms around. Look, if I say to the NIH, I want to decompose the fitness for this new system, and this cockamamie system tells me that within error bars there are 10 traits that matter, that's good to know, as opposed to I don't know where there are 1,000 traits that I need to get my hands around.
I mean, there is another thing, along microzyme, if one says that there's a modest number of phenotypic properties that matter, but then there's some nonlinear, strongly nonlinear mapping between those phenotypes and the fitness. Mm-hmm. Okay, and for example, that you can have things where it's the worst thing that matters. Or if you're going down, or the best thing that matters, right? And so you can have things which are much sharper than things like a nice smooth curve like that. And then some of those have stopped being much more biologically plausible, mm-hmm. also. And so if one puts, if one can put those in, and with assumptions of, okay, if I say there's two phenotypes, and ask, well, how well, what would you get for this, or if there's three, it's all one. And then the mutations couple, relatively randomly in the sense that they affect, each mutation affects several of those phenotypes. Typical things, then one could presumably start doing some kind of analysis. I mean, but one needs a sort of bigger class of
models.
Of models which are don't have all all the nonlinearity sort of put in one place and have some other biochemical sort of plausibility. Right? I mean, it's the.
But you could possibly think of a simple model that would just go one step beyond an additive model. Which is that you have two, for example, you could assume you want to test the hypothesis that you live in a two-dimensional space. So you could imagine that each of the mutations has an additive effect on each of these dimensions, and then you write the fitness as a function of these two.
Right.
Then you just have one non-linearity.
Right.
Like you have a linear term plus a non-linear term, which is possibly small.
In phenotype space, in this two-dimensional
space. Moreover, you cannot assume it, but measure it, because basically along each line, you can make a very clear experiment measuring, especially for your term lactamase system, you can make a very clear experiment measuring fitness along one line or that line. Whatever you assume physically about each line, you can get fitness as a function, not assuming Gaussian, but fitness as a function of position along one dimension, whatever it is physically, fitness along another. And then a very interesting question is how they talk to each other.
But you can't control traits. All you have at your disposal are mutations, which are largely pleiotropic.
You can measure fitness under different conditions.
Yeah exactly.
And if you have enough dimensions,
that
then you cover it.
I mean, if you know what dimensions you are talking about, for example, let me be specific, stability and concentration. Maybe not necessarily that, but just to be specific. So you can do experiments measuring fitness versus stability and keeping concentration fixed.
But how can you change stability without also changing kcat over km?
Yeah, that's another question. Then kind of you can select mutations which would not affect kcat over km.
So it's not a trivial knob.
It's not a trivial thing, but it is impossible.
Okay.
But you don't need to check if you measure fitness in the different and the different conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're different enough from each other, and you've got five different directions in which you're measuring it, and it's a three-dimensional space, you're gonna that's information you can get out. You don't have to know the directions.
So when you say conditions, you mean let's say different drug concentrations, different temperatures, different pHs.
Right. But you want things which you hope some of them affect more the activity, some of them are going to affect more the stability, and so on. And you obviously don't want them all to be sort of close to each other. But as long as there's relatively big angles between them, in some sense, one could make more precise.
Now you
start covering the space if it's low dimensional.
Now you mean, and I appreciate your point, and I think what you're saying is now when you use the word angle, you mean angle between environmental components. Do you want to change pH, let's say, on the premise that it, whatever that does to the cell has, is unrelated to what changing temperature does?
So I would say I don't the connection between what I think the phenotypic traits are from the protein level and what they actually are, one could say we don't know, and it's not even that clear how well defined it is. But there is a set of axes which you can measure with different fitnesses. And you can ask, can you, once you start doing that, you can start seeing what something about the dimension of the spaces is in it if you make some assumptions about that the mutations are linearly or close to linearly affecting these.
I just want to...
There's a way of doing it, but you don't have, you don't know what the... plays ahead of time, but you have to make multi-dimensional measurements. And the problem that Boris said, you're making one-dimensional measurement because you just got the fitness, and you're trying to infer something about other dimensions. Mm. But if the dimensions of the number of measurements you're making is larger than the dimension of the relative phenotypic space, then you can get out of that information.
Yeah, that's a very interesting suggestion. I've never thought about that.
The saturation information is how much extra do you
change. Right. This will be the last thing on the subject by fiat. But what's not clear to me is what the relationship is between the dimensions of the space in which the experiment varies on the one hand and these dimensions that we maybe are interested in.
Well, let's call those the phenotype.
I see. You say...
Phenotype is, here's a list of fitnesses under these five different conditions. That's a phenotype.
Yes.
Okay? I mean, fitness is a high-dimensional thing, and
sure,
as far as the cell is concerned, it doesn't care about the protein.
That's correct.
It cares about all kinds of complicated things that the protein, is involved in, right? And so sometimes if you really understand extremely well, maybe you can nail down the properties of the protein. Mm-hmm. But I think most of the time, you want to define your phenotype as fitness under different conditions, or other properties under different conditions. And that's the bits of the phenotype that the cell cares about.
Yeah.
Right? The cell doesn't care about what one thinks is sort of the microscopic aspects of it.
Yeah. It's just not obvious to me whether making... I think it's fascinating and important to make fitness measurements in lots of different environments.
Right.
Grant you that.
But
biochemistry. Maybe the conclusion is none, and that's
the biochemistry life. Doesn't tell one about the biology.
We can probably.
No, it does.
We're in good shape. We're in good shape. So the other theoretical thing, I'm only going to put one slide on because I actually don't know anything about it, despite having just gotten some money to play with it, is the idea of using metabolic control analysis, another perhaps dubious theoretical construct, to again take data on epistasis now between genes and make inferences about mechanism. And the premise here is that we can imagine lots of different topologies of metabolic networks, and the object of the game is to maximize total flux through the network. And now we put in deleterious mutations in one or another of the genes coding E's or enzymes, put mutations into one or another of these enzymes, and then pairs of these enzymes, and ask about the epistasis between them and try to work backwards to make inferences about topology. This isn't new with us. There was a lovely paper written by Aristeth Mari some years ago that made some very general points, and Daniel Segre with Roy Cascione wrote a nice paper in Nature Genetics a few years ago that did some of this as well. I won't say any more about it because I have no results, but it's just in the same vein at this low level, trying to say something about the topology, the topography of fitness function in terms of mechanism. All right? So that's parts 1 and 2. And part 3, I have somewhat less, again, to say, the dynamics of adaptation. And in particular, I've been interested in the importance of recombination within populations on the dynamics and opportunities for adaptation. And I'm going to talk about two projects that I've been involved in. One is in collaboration with Richard Watson, who's a computer scientist in Southampton, on the characteristics, the properties of fitness functions that genetic recombination is particularly apt at solving. And this is a paper that came out in Evolution earlier this year. And then work that I presented to many of you in Aspen last winter, but I'll give a somewhat more abbreviated form, in which I've been trying to think about trajectories, the space in which to think about trajectories in populations with genetic recombination. So it's easy to see under strong selection weak mutation, there's essentially no population polymorphism. And so I can imagine a population moving through the hypercube. But what's the right way to think about populations' trajectories when recombination is present? And I have a suggestion, which is interesting to me. Okay, so genome structure and the benefit of a question?
Would it be an option to relegate this to
certainly
an extra little talk?
It's
not clear to me. I mean,
it is
45 minutes.
It's not 45 minutes, but it's probably, it would take us past noon, and I'm happy to stop now. I really don't want to
maybe
impose.
Sometime next week or so, we will certainly have, because this looks like very interesting.
I'd be very happy to stop here.
Rather than rush through it.
Yeah. We've had several talks where the last 15 minutes then have to get rehashed at another occasion. So why don't we do that, plan to do that? I'd be delighted to do that. Thank you for the suggestion. Yeah, so we'll table this for another time. When people are interested, I'd be glad to do this formally or informally. And thank you very much for your attention. Oh, actually, I'll show you the very last slide. Let's just acknowledge the people whose names you haven't heard. A lot of the beta-lactamase, all the beta-lactamase work was done when I was a postdoc with Dan Hartle. I mentioned Richard Watson, and you'll hear a bit more about him, and these guys were important for me in the lab. And these are folks that have made some important contributions since I've gotten to Brown. Okay, questions?